Hi there, this is Wayne Ranney, and I will be the interviewer of Don Chase. We're at the Prescott Public Library on April the 7th, 2023. It's 10 a.m. Don, thank you for being here, and maybe you could just state your name and address and when you were born.
Well, my name's Don Chase. I was born in Seattle, Washington, and actually my dad worked at on the shipyards there, and me being born on January 31st, 1942, and him working at a shipyard, which is an essential industry, made it possible that he didn't have to go and get involved in Second World War. And
he would have been the age to go to the war.
He would have definitely been. Yeah. And we moved down to Southern California when I was, I guess, about 4 years old. And so I attended high school in Downey, California, and then ended up going to Cal Poly. And
Pomona or San Luis Obispo?
Pomona, but I took some classes up at San Luis too, at least one. And for summer work, you know, I never had to make a loan going to college, but I was never so broke that I couldn't afford to buy a beer on a weekend either, which is pretty nice. And that was possible because I got a job in the summer with the Forest Service working on a fire crew, the hotshots in Chileo, high up on the Angeles Crest Highway. And that really fit into my love of nature, being out in nature, even though I was cutting plants the whole time.
How did you get that job with the Forest Service?
You know, I just put an application in, and I think I hit it at a real lucky time. And I sort of stretched out my college career because Cal Poly was on the quarter system, so I'd skip a quarter so I could work the whole fire season, because if you really wanted to get rehired the next year, you pretty much had to stick around for the whole fire season. And I had a great camp superintendent, an old Taos, New Mexico Indian, Pete Trujillo. Just a hellraiser, but really knew fire and fire control. We'd be on some kind of big fire, and we were just one crew set to cut line, and the fire boss would pull him off a side and try to pick his brain on where we should be backfiring and do things, because Pete really knew fire. He had been supposedly on the fire in New Mexico when the original Smokey Bear Cub was.
Oh, and it was
his crew that saved that cub. Yeah.
Fantastic.
And that experience, I ended up being a pusher on the crew, which is a pusher, and I was lead hook, which is a great job. But and I'd put in job applications with the Park Service. And before I got the Forest Service job, I never connected on them. But with my experience on that hotshot crew, suddenly several of the parks were interested and hired me. And I got a job as a seasonal, as a fire control foreman of a crew at Sequoia and Kings Canyon, which is just a peach of a job. Just had a five-person crew and a tanker. But we'd mostly go to lightning fires, and Sequoia and Kings Canyon was what a superb park to work in, you know. And I spent as much time as I could in the backcountry there. And when I ended up working at Kings Canyon End, our crew was, we were a long ways from headquarters, and if they had a lightning strike late one afternoon, if we waited until the next day, the helitack crew from Ash Mountain headquarters would go to the fire and we wouldn't get time. So we always would boom out of there and hike all night to get to a fire. And so be there and already have line cut around it. That was a good way to do that.
And I just want to capture a little bit of dates. How many seasons did you do at the Angeles National Forest?
I think it was three seasons with on a hotshot crew.
And you probably started about 1960?
It was in the 60s.
Okay.
And then when I got hired at Sequoia National Park, I worked there two summers being a fire control foreman, and I graduated in 66 from Cal Poly with a degree in, sort of mixed degree in natural science and landscape architecture. They actually had a park planning degree there for a while then. And I put in for a permanent job with the Park Service and got hired. And so at the end of my second season at Sequoia, I went to Albright Training Center and was there for 3 months with a whole bunch of people like Craig Johnson and a bunch of the other crazies. And we had a great time at the Canyon.
Would this have been the mid to late 60s?
This was, it was 66 and 67.
Okay.
Yeah, I think over Christmas, I think.
Okay.
And I was assigned to the first park. I think there was a feeling I had a few rough edges that could be knocked off. And I got assigned to Lake Mead.
So you were out of the firefighting business when you took the job at Lake Mead, and you were probably, what, a patrol ranger?
I was a patrol ranger, yeah. That wasn't my idea of what a national park should be or anything, but I got qualified as a scuba diver, sort of accelerated it, because the Army had, or the military called me in for my pre-induction physical while I was at Albright. And I got drafted.
Oh.
And, you know, I couldn't very well say, hey, I'm opposed to this war and I'm opposed to that thing and move up to Canada or something. So I did my 2 years in the Army and 1 year over in Nam.
Wow.
And matter of fact, I've got about 7 years ago, I came down with multiple myeloma cancer. I'd been really pretty darn healthy up until that. And VA admitted that it was Agent Orange over in Vietnam was a major contributor towards that. So I get all my health care with VA now. So that's worked out well. And my multiple myeloma, which is not curable, but it's in remission right now. So I'm in doing real well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you got hired at Lake Mead and then got drafted. Did you do any scuba diving or ranger
work? I did, because when I came back out of the Army, went back to Mead right away. In 2 years working at Mead, I did 14 body recoveries.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Any of them in barrels or cement shoes?
No, but a couple of them were very suspicious off of some of the casino boats,
yeah.
You know. Like, people aren't supposed to be run over by a boat and then backed up over them again. You know, that's not considered proper.
I guess you were probably stationed at Boulder Bay or Las Vegas.
Originally at Boulder Beach.
Okay.
And then Colville, you know, the North yeah. Shore Road was just opened up about that time when I was first there. And so Angus Ross and I were the first Rangers at Colville. And that was sort of a fun place to work because you could... get out and spend time out in the country quite a bit. You know?
That is one of the most scenic roads in all of the Southwest, that North Lake Shore
Drive. When I make the drive from Logan down here, I choose to break off the big freeway and just cut over to and drive that North Shore Road.
And you miss Las Vegas that way.
Yeah,
you get all that scenery.
Yeah. That was the worst thing about working at Lake Mead was Vegas was a closed city.
Yeah.
And then I got a job offer while I was at Colville to be a backcountry ranger at Sequoia and Kings.
Oh.
And I was going, yahoo!
Yeah.
And I was married at that time. Got married sort of while I was in the Army type thing, you know. And we enjoyed... being at Sequoia. At first I was over at Lodgepole on the west side, and then they decided they, with all those entries into the backcountry on the east side, they wanted to have a ranger permanently on the east side. And I wasn't given any choice in the matter. Just said, hey, guess what? You're going to be moving over to the east side. Go find yourself a place to live.
And that would be Lone Pine? Or?
Well, I lived in Bishop, actually, just north of Bishop. There was a California Division of Forestry fire camp there, and they had it was just a real small trailer park. And so I bought a mobile home, and my wife and I lived in that mobile home for a while there.
What was her name?
Janice.
Yeah. Okay.
And we ended up splitting up during that whole thing. And I think fairly friendly split.
Okay.
We just sort of both agreed that's what we wanted. And I would have probably stayed in that job because it was a good one. And I loved working at backcountry and was instrumental in establishing. That was the first backcountry area that had a permit system and that limited use.
Oh.
And so all those trailheads from the east side, as soon as you got to the park, you had to have a permit going in. And I think it worked out pretty well. We allowed a lot of freedom. We just did the permits, not based on where you're going to be camping, but on the entry point.
They still do it that way.
And I think it was the right way to do it, because then it could allow people freedom in the backcountry instead of you having to stay at one campground for 2 days.
And it still regulates the number of people that go in, so it does the job.
And we had real good records from those little fire permits we'd give. You weren't required to have them, but rangers filled out fire permits. They knew how many entries we had from these different points to do that.
Were you involved at all with the setting up of that management?
I got one of those incentive award things for that program being successfully initiated. I think because the first district we did was the Ray Lakes Loop.
Oh, I love that trail.
And so it was the entrances from the east side and then from
Kearsarge Pass, Glen Pass, and over to Ray Lakes. That's wonderful.
In fact, I had a seasonal ranger living in a little house trailer up on for Kearsarge Pass, checking out all the people.
And so this was the late 60s then, or early 70s?
That was early 70s.
And how many seasons were you the backcountry ranger at King's
County? I was year-round.
It was year-round?
So I'd find excuses to ski in the backcountry in the winter.
So you were a
and in, the, in that those days, if you skied in the backcountry, you would never even find another track. Or if you did, it was one of the snow survey people. You know, it was... And
a golden moment to be there.
Oh, it was great. Yeah. But I was there from until I went to Grand Canyon. And probably the main reason of going to Grand Canyon, I liked Grand Canyon, but it was just nice getting a cleaner break from the relationship I'd had with Janice and all the things with Bishop. God, that's an awful nice community. But
how many seasons do you think you did as the backcountry ranger?
Five.
Wouldn't be seasons. It would be
5 years. I was there 5 years.
Okay. Do you remember the year you went to Grand Canyon?
No. I remember the year I left, but and it's getting fuzzy when I say it. I left in 78.
You left in 78. Okay.
Yeah.
So.
And I was at Grand Canyon at least 4 years.
At least four. Okay.
Yeah, maybe five.
Okay. Well, that sounds about right. I'm really struck by how similar our life paths are because I grew up in Southern California.
Really?
In Pomona.
Yeah.
And I went to Cal Poly for 2 years.
You did.
And I lived in Bishop at a California Division of Forestry thing in the summer of 75.
Oh, no kidding.
And that's where I was working when I took a 2-week vacation and did a backpack in Bryce, a backpack in Zion, and a backpack rim to rim in the Grand Canyon.
Ah.
That's the trip where my friends at the end of the Grand Canyon hike drove back to California and I said, I'm staying to look for a job. And that's when you and I intersected each other. I started at Grand Canyon October the 6th, 1975. And I guess now we can pick up with your Grand Canyon career. When I met you, you were the district ranger at Desert View.
Well, and they called it a unit manager then.
Okay.
There was that concept they had for a while that they were pushing, and they had it at Grand Canyon, and it got dissolved about the time I left. The next ranger that came in there didn't manage maintenance, natural resources, and the ranger activities and the naturalist activities. And when I was there, that was the deal. I was supposed to be over all those. And I thought it worked ideally in Desert View, because like the one of the things we teach all the seasonals, what's the most important thing for the visitor at Desert View? Toilets. and Spider Hartley, you know.
Oh, Spider.
Bless his heart. He was what a contrary old son of a bitch. But he kept those, he and his wife kept those toilets clean.
I haven't thought about Spider since my Grand Canyon days. He was sort of a hunched over, wrinkly kind of guy, but he was...
And he'd let his hair grow all the way, all year, and then he'd shave it, and he'd do the same thing to his son. He would shave his son's head once a year. And
so Spider was in charge of the maintenance at Desert View.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you probably left Sequoia Kings Canyon late in the 60s, maybe early in the 70s. And then you went to Grand Canyon probably by 73 or 74, and you were there until 78.
Yeah.
And were you the first unit manager at Desert View, or did they have that already established?
I think Valder, I believe, I never met him, but I think that was the name of the person that was the unit manager there before, and I think he was the first.
Okay.
And doing the unit manager thing there.
I do remember the unit manager on the North Rim, Rick Gale.
That's Rick Gale, for sure.
Yes.
Yep.
And then they had the unit manager for the Inner Canyon, which was Pete Nichols.
And then Marv Jensen.
Yeah. And that's when I was there. Pete Nichols initially gave me my job.
Uh-huh.
And then Marv Jensen got hired on to be in charge of the Inner Canyon. Because Pete Nichols, if you remember, really didn't like Grand Canyon.
Oh, I knew him, but I didn't know him real well. And I didn't know he didn't like the canyon, though.
Well, he was from Mississippi. And
oh, yeah.
He might have been put at Grand Canyon because he didn't fit in anywhere else. I'm just speculating, but
the
scuttlebutt was that he didn't really like it. And he ended up going to Natchez Trace after he left Grand Canyon. So anyway, you show up at Desert View. Talk about that a little bit. I mean, you lived at Desert View and...
Well, like I say, I thought it was an ideal spot to where you looked after all of those things, because I thought of the parks as a whole experience for people, and it was important to maintain roads, and it was important to, if you decided you were going to have a maintained trail, it had to be maintained, and if you're going to do an interpretive program, they should be done as high a quality as you could get. I had Steve Pine doing interpretive talks, evening walks there. These people were getting super high level of academic stuff on things.
He's an academic. By the way, Steve Pine, P-Y-N... E, and he ended up becoming a fire ecologist and writing some books. He's
just retired, and he was a full professor down at and in fact there was one issue of one of the men's magazines,
maybe Men's Journal.
No, it was one of the sort of Scholastic men's magazines. But it had him featured in there as one of the young geniuses of that was going to be successful in the world.
I knew that he also spent time at the North Rim.
Yeah, he was a fire control foreman over there.
But he was an interpreter for you.
Yeah.
Giving evening talks.
Sonia was worked for me, and she actually helped me hire Steve for that one time that he worked, you know, and she was pretty proud of that, that she helped him get that job. You know?
So Sonia's your current wife?
No.
Okay.
That's Sheila Miller.
Is your current wife?
Yeah. Okay. No, we're not married.
You're not married.
Yeah,
okay.
We're enjoying living.
But who's
together.
Sonia then? Who?
Well, that was Steve Pine's wife, and they're still married.
Oh, okay.
And she's real straight arrow LDS.
Oh, wow.
And
was she working at the park?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Part of that sort of the seasonal crew. She worked over on the North Rim too. In fact, I think she was on Steve's fire crew.
Okay. So who are some of the people that were there at Desert View when you first came? You've mentioned Stephen Pine. Was Mike Ebersole then there?
Not right at first.
Yeah, okay.
But right away, he was one of the talented people we hired. And let's see, Brian Swift was a ranger.
Okay.
And then we could, our training things that we did, we'd have a pretty intensive training time with everybody working together. And so when I did search and rescue training, it involved the maintenance people as well as everybody else.
Oh, wow.
And you didn't want Spider being out there climbing and doing rope stuff, but he'd hit direct traffic and do stuff. And one of the other maintenance guys was really good at doing the rescue things. I can't remember his name now, but by that team approach of everybody was all on the same team. Because I thought in the village at Grand Canyon, it was so split up. There were the rangers that did tickets for speeding, and that's what they look out for them. And then there was the naturalists, and they stayed off by themselves, and they had to give pretty, some of their programs were pretty boring in the village. Yeah. And the maintenance people, they were definitely off on their own thing.
Yeah.
And out at Desert View, everybody sort of, during that training session, especially when you got people on ropes and stuff, and you were teaching knots, it didn't matter what their background was. You could see that some people were just quick at learning that stuff and were the kind of people you wanted backing you up if you got into a situation.
So was this your idea to have all the different departments at Desert View work together on this search and rescue?
Well, yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think because that had been my strong point at at Sequoia and actually at Lake Mead. We didn't have to have any rock climbing rescues, but I did rock climbing classes for the wives, which was a fun thing. We had some canyons behind the housing area where you could rig up a good rappel spot and do a little raising and lowering and stuff.
Well, you know, people often ask me with my outdoor career if I've ever been a rock climber, and I say no, but I did rappel off the rim of the Grand Canyon once, and that's when I was a seasonal ranger at Phantom Ranch. And I believe you were responsible for that search and rescue training. And we were out not too far on the West Rim Drive.
Yeah.
Rappelling off of the rim of the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a great place to, and because that type of training, the search and rescue stuff, can really bond people together.
Yes, it's
teamwork. And it helped me. I was told that because we bordered the Navajo Nation on Desert View, part of my job was going to be to cooperate with the Navajo tribe because, God, they were doing trespass grazing out there and ignoring the boundary. We didn't have it fenced at all. In fact, Ebersole, he's the one that got that boundary surveyed to get it fenced.
Wow.
But I stepped into the thing of teaching search and rescue at the Navajo Cop Academy over at Window Rock about once a year. It'd be a short week. You'd have the training with Navajo cops on search and rescue, again, mostly rock climbing stuff. You'd do it on those on the Window Rocks.
Wow.
And and that was a way of sort of doing something cooperative with the tribe and trying to open up avenues of communication a little bit, because they really weren't very well open. And Euler was the anthropologist hired there, but he was hired there and sort of directed by Goldwater to be hired, is the way I pretty much heard it.
Oh.
And he really, it pissed off people in the park.
Oh, really?
Because he was hired at a really upper level GS thing. And who was the guy that was in charge of all of the natural resources in the...
Dave Oxner.
Oxner. But Oxner didn't really get along well with...
Euler?
With Euler.
Uh-huh.
But Euler loved the Desert View Unit because, again, for the training, we get everybody together, the maintenance guys and everybody, with Euler talking about the archaeology of the canyon. So you're getting some of the super high-quality talks, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, as the unit manager, did you get to hire the people that worked at Desert View? In other words, did you hire Mike Ebersole?
Either I did or the ranger that worked for me did, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't coming down from Grand Canyon Village.
No, it was, and all, it was hiring, all us doing the hiring out there.
All you do.
Yeah.
And what was Mike Ebersole? Was he an interpreter or a patrol ranger? I know he ended up going out to Tuweap for many years, and he
yeah,
was
that was afterwards. Yeah, I can't remember. I think we hired him as a naturalist.
Yeah,
but I'm not absolutely sure on that.
What about Susan Lamb? Was she there in your time?
I can't remember that name. So
maybe you had left by the time Susan Lamb was out there. She's also a, sort of a well-known Flagstaff writer now, but she started out as an interpreter at Grand Canyon.
And then my one, I was very happy at being at Grand Canyon again. But as a kid up in Seattle, my earliest remembrance is of my... Godfather was an old Slovak, spoke very broken English. Our family kept in close contact with him, and he would work summers up in Alaska, either on fishing or on, he did some work in the railway up there too. And I can remember sitting on his lap and him telling me stories about how great Alaska was. So when I got an offer to go to Glacier Bay, I wasn't putting in applications.
Uh-huh.
But I got an offer to go to Glacier Bay as chief of operations, chief ranger.
I remember when you
it was in '78.
I remember when you left.
We had a great party.
I don't think I went to that party.
Oh, I got a good picture of Marv Jensen with a beer can in his hand.
Wow. You know,
he's really very conservative,
yeah.
LDS.
Yeah.
He doesn't drink very much, but he was sure enjoying himself.
That's fantastic. I think I've seen him with a beer, too, at a river guide party.
It'd be impossible not to have one with a river guide party.
So I don't know. You probably don't remember this, but in the winter of 77, 78... you hired me as a volunteer along with my girlfriend, Cindy Kane. And I don't remember living at Desert View, but we must have been living
maybe
there.
Maybe you lived in the village, maybe.
Possibly.
Maybe she had a place in the village or something.
Well, originally we met when she worked at Phantom Ranch for Fred Harvey.
Yeah.
And I was an Inner Canyon Ranger. The reason I mention this is because during that winter that we volunteered, and I worked, I just was behind the desk at the Tucson Ruin.
Oh, yeah.
And this was during the winter, so it wasn't real busy.
Yeah, very slow, but you'd get some quality visits.
That's
in there.
Right.
If they took time to turn off there at the Tucson Museum, there was a chance they could get an experience at the canyon they'd never forget, really.
Yes, exactly. And that was really good for me. I even made a geologic exhibit that we had. It was temporary, but
yeah.
I had rock samples
From and all the different layers?
Yeah, and I typed up these little index cards and put them next to the rock sample. And I remember you said, well, this is really an archaeological museum, but sure, go ahead. That sounds good.
Yeah.
But the main thing is, during this time, there was the rumor that the Tanner Trail was either 12 or 14 miles long. And you said to Cindy and I, why don't you guys hike that trail with this measuring wheel and see how long that trail really is? I don't think it's 12 or 14 miles. That's what you said to us.
Yeah.
And so we did. We took that little measuring wheel and we hiked all the way down the Tanner.
And pain in the ass keeping that right on contact.
Yes, but, it is. Yeah. And you know, you go over the water bars or the riffraff, or you know. Anyway, we get to the river and it measured 7.5 miles.
Yeah.
And we were shocked. So we measured on the way up as well.
Yeah.
And it came out at 7.75.
Wow.
So I think it was Harvey Bouchard that had in his book that the Tanner Trail is 12 to 14. You were very skeptical about that.
Yeah,
and you were the one who put us on to that measuring. And I often think about that and I go, talk about being young. Not only going down the Tanner and then back out, but then doing it with a measuring wheel.
Yeah.
That's the only time I've really seen a mountain lion really good on our hike down. Cindy was hiking in front of me. We were just past Escalante Saddle there. And I looked up ahead, and this mountain lion loped across the Tanner Trail from left to right. And I wanted to tell Cindy to look up. She was looking at her feet going down the trail. I couldn't get the words out. And by the time I got the words out, the mountain lion had gone down.
Ooh.
And, you know.
What a pleasure, though, man.
But the other thing I remember about you at Desert View is that, yes, she was living in the village. And we were trying to connect with each other. I was living in Desert View and she was living in the village.
Uh-huh,
and there was one time when I got a ride to the village, but she got a ride to Desert View and we missed each other.
Yeah.
And then we both did the same thing in the opposite direction. And you turned to me and you said this to me. You said, Wayne, sometimes you can try too hard with a lady. And I never forgot that, because really, I was trying really hard. And I think our relationship was starting towards that rocky period, and I was trying to make it work. And I remember you telling me, Wayne, you can try too hard sometimes.
Well, and you know, another fun thing we did out there was, you know, that little patrol cabin, I think we called it the deer cabin, at the boundary there at, somewhere around Grandview Point, where the dirt road would take off and go to the boundary, and the Forest Service had the lookout back
there.
Yes,
yes, okay.
I would try to schedule the first full moon of the winter when we had snow on the ground. We would try to do a open party for anybody that wanted to ski into the cabin, and we'd have a hot mulled wine thing. I'd get that started, and it was sort of, it was a potluck. You could bring food and share it, you know, and it was, but no planning, with none of this, your name ends with this and you got to bring this and stuff. And I remember Euler again, he got out there and he'd get into the booze a little bit, and he was not in control of it, and he had one ski came off and he made it out, but I had to go like and retrieve a ski and stuff the next day. But he had a great time back there, but that was a treat. And then if on a full moon, you'd go on to that Forest Service tower, and you could actually peer into the canyon and get a little moonlight on Vishnu Temple.
Right.
Stuff.
That tower is still there.
Yeah.
You can still go up on it. And, of course, the cabin is still there. Did you get along okay with the superintendent, Merle Stitt?
I did. And Merle wanted me to switch. There was some kind of a deal that the management staff had decided, maybe they were they were going to offer me the Inner Canyon Ranger job. It wasn't the river job, but it was the Inner Canyon job. And I just said to Merle, I said, look, would I have more responsibility there or less? I think it looks to me like it'd be less, and I'd rather not. And that's all I had to say to him. But I think they'd all worked that out, as they were going to do a switch and move me down, just because I obviously liked being in the Inner Canyon.
Yeah.
And that would have been an interesting job to do, but it wouldn't have had the subtleties of all the different stuff, an entrance station, EMT work, and everything else. So, and he let me get out of that without another word said. That was pretty cool. And I really got along with Merle.
Okay.
And then, the assistant superintendent,
Bruce Shaw,
he did my performance evaluations. I didn't get along with him at all.
I don't think many people did.
He hardly ever came out there and saw what we had going on at Desert View. Didn't know what was going on. And he was a weak stick.
Yeah, he was very strict with us Inner Canyon Rangers.
He had a cute daughter, though.
He did?
Yeah.
I never met her. But when we Inner Canyon Rangers would come out of the canyon, we immediately had to have our hiking boots polished, and we had to be in the Class A uniform. We couldn't be in the trail uniform.
Oh, jeez.
It was just... He was one of those kinds of guys. He was a real stickler for rules.
Yeah.
Hardly ever smiled. And he wasn't a pleasant guy.
Yeah.
And a lot of people had that. On the other hand...
But he looked real good in a uniform.
Well, he was, you know, as sharp as a tack in a uniform.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you had the reputation, and I remember this well, you were just such a great person to work for. You had this very outgoing, easy, and fun attitude.
Oh, that's nice to say. I hope I really appreciated the people I had working for me. A lot of them went on to varied wild careers and stuff.
Name a few.
Ebersol.
Mike Ebersol, yeah.
Yeah, and... Cunningham went on, I think he became a U.S. Marshal.
Oh, really?
But Mike Cunningham, you know, he was the one that didn't get along with Kunzel very well. And he would have flattened Kunzel in a minute.
By the way, Don is talking about the chief law enforcement ranger at the South Rim, Ernie Kunzel, K-U-N-C-L. And I know we're going to talk about Ernie a little bit because you probably have... stories about Ernie. He was a larger-than-life personality at Grand Canyon. I think he was there for 10 or 15
and
years.
And really good. He would get into whatever activity he was into, he'd get really good at, like his medical stuff.
Yes.
He was super good at medical things and good at training for people on the medical things, too. And the law enforcement, he was, I would have to admit, he's good at. He would get overzealous.
Yes.
He had reputation among all the concession employees, but look out if you got a joint anyplace, because Ernie will find it and bust you for it. You know?
Apparently, Ernie put on a long-haired wig and was peddling marijuana in the campground, and people would say yes, he'd bust them.
Yeah.
And I mean, these are rumors that we all heard, and, you know, he was very, very keen on marijuana, and he was going to nip that in the bud, if you'll pardon the pun.
Yeah.
And that's what I was saying about you. You had the exact opposite approach to a Park Service job. It was really meant to be fun and rewarding, and it didn't have to be this burden that you had to carry around wearing the green and brown.
Now, there might be some hard work involved. You know,
right.
Working at weird hours at night on a traffic accident out on the road, or setting up an interpretive program. You had to do a lot of that on your own to get together to do a program that was interesting.
Yeah.
But it was fun to do, and you could have fun. And like when we did employee training, we'd have a big potluck party. I'm big into potluck parties. Because especially bachelors get to eat real well at potluck parties. But food does bring people together.
Well, and I think
at the Desert View there, we had a crummy housing area.
Yeah.
Mostly mobile homes. But we always had a good fire ring and a volleyball court.
Yes, I remember
and
that.
Picnic tables. So we could, at the drop of a hat, if somebody had one of their relatives visiting, let's do a potluck tonight and see who shows up. And you'd be out there sitting around with a campfire going on and a can of beer here or there and have a pretty good time.
Well, you know, I remember that very well. And as I was driving down to Prescott today, I was just thinking, I remember Don's reputation. And I hadn't thought about that for a long time. But, you know, you were really one of the bright spots at Grand Canyon's rim environment.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of bright spots down in the canyon. We didn't work with our bosses right away. And so we had a lot of freedom down there. But you were just a real fun guy, and you were always ready for a potluck or a get-together.
I appreciate you saying that. I consider it a privilege to having worked at Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I hate to say it, but I don't consider working at Lake Mead such a privilege. You know, I really enjoy driving that North Shore Road, but I don't think that was a privilege. And I wasn't really looking to find 14 bodies to recover out of that lake, mostly.
Now, I forgot to mention at the start of this interview that if there's anything you're uncomfortable talking about, you don't have to talk about it. And I forgot to mention that. And the reason I bring that up right now is that when I arrived at Grand Canyon in 1975, there was this story that there were parties where the people in Grand Canyon Village would go to parties and there was wife swapping.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that at all?
Did that happen? I remember hearing it, but not knowing any of the individuals involved.
Okay.
And some of it, I think, occurred just before I went there.
Okay.
And one of the people was, at least one, maybe two of them were, I think, instructors at Albright Training Center.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know if the stories were made up or not.
Exactly. And again, I was just a lowly seasonal who had just arrived, and this was already an event that was in the past.
Yeah.
And so the stories I heard were either true or exaggerated or false or all of the above.
Yeah, I didn't know anything personally about anything going on like that, but I heard those rumors,
so
and
probably
I just let it off as some of the funny village stories.
Well, I'm a little bit interested in talking to somebody who might know more about it, and I just thought I'd bring it up with you. So you got along with Merle okay. It's so unfortunate. He passed away 6 months after he retired.
Yeah, what a nice guy.
He retired down to Tucson, and then like a lot of people, a lot of men, if you don't have anything you're retiring to, you sort of feel like you're just floating out there.
Yeah.
I guess that's what happened to Merle. And then Joe Miller was the chief of maintenance. He had some good-looking daughters, and he used to hang out with them. And Dave Smith's daughter, Coley Smith.
Well, and Joe divorced his wife. He and his wife divorced. And then Joe got married to Sheila. And I'm one of the only people that knows Sheila. Three different last names she's had. She's a Gates from Utah, but she married a guy in college named Langley.
Okay.
And he worked seasonally at Grand Canyon for a little bit too.
Okay.
And she worked there seasonally, and anyway.
And they broke up, and then that's when she met Joe.
Yeah.
And she became Sheila Miller.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's her name still.
Yeah, and she still keeps track of Joe's kids. She's in communication with most of them. There's one daughter doesn't talk to her at all, but the rest of them, one's living in New Mexico, I think.
I don't remember any of the
daughters' names.
Real small
town, yeah, but nice, very nice people.
You know, I might want to ask Sheila about those girls because we did a lot of hikes together and a lot of things.
Yeah.
I never dated.
She's tried to picture you because your name didn't strike anything with her. And the same thing with you. You didn't strike up anything, any remembers of Sheila Miller. But her job was like the campground ranger for a while. And then she worked the entrance station.
Okay.
And then she ended up being a secretary for various positions in the park there, too.
Okay.
And she was Joe's secretary for a while.
Okay. Now, did Joe retire from Grand Canyon, or did he go somewhere?
No, he went on to several other parks.
Oh, okay.
And then he retired, but then he got rehired as an annuitant and kept working again. So he sort of stretched his career out.
Okay.
And then they had they were living in Logan, Utah, but they had a cabin in southern Utah there in the mountains, really a nice log cabin that he built. And Sheila was gone. She worked with that program for that does the schooling for mostly men that tries to get jobs in the outdoors for them. I forget the name of the program. But anyway, she was off doing her work, and he went and bought a new snowmobile, brought it up to the cabin, unloaded it, went into his cabin and laid down on the bed and had a heart attack and died, you know.
How long ago was that?
It's been a good 12 years ago. It was
that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Hopefully he made it to his 70s.
Yeah, I think he probably was just into his 70s when he died, yeah.
And then how did you and Sheila get together after
he passed away? Well, actually, I knew her when she was married to Langley at Lake Mead.
Oh, okay.
And she actually, when she came to Grand Canyon, she didn't have housing, and she had her daughter then, Melinda, and she lived with me out at Desert View for a while.
Okay.
Another common law thing. And that didn't work out super well because of some other activities I was involved in, I guess.
So you mean you had round one with Sheila at
Desert View? Yeah, that was a good round, too. It was good. Yeah.
And then you went to Alaska, and she probably went with Joe somewhere.
Yeah, and she and Joe and her daughter came up and visited me when I was chief ranger at old Glacier Bay, you know. And so we kept in touch and would exchange Christmas cards and stuff. And then I guess it was maybe 4 years after Joe died, I was heading up to Alaska, and I said, hey, could I stop by and see you? And she was, she would like to say she didn't know if she should do that.
Uh-huh.
But she was anxious to see me, and it worked out pretty good.
Wow, so you guys have been together about 8 years now.
Yeah, and then I came down with this cancer thing, and she was actually a two-time cancer survivor, and the reason my cancer did so much damage to my spinal column, I've lost 4.5 inches of height. I wasn't very tall anyway.
Wow.
But because I had lower back pain, and I went to the emergency room at the VA hospital out here, and they did a little blood draw and stuff, and they couldn't diagnose it, and got a little worse. I went to the emergency room again and went in for my annual physical and did all the things, and I had to go out on my own and find a doctor to try to help diagnose it, really, when it was finally diagnosed as multiple myeloma. And by the time it was diagnosed, it had caused considerable damage. Myeloma is a blood plasma cancer. You know, so it gets in the bone things. And I, like the one reading of a CT scan. They were counting how many lytic lesions on my spinal column, and they just said excess of 100.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so it was pretty messed up by that time.
And do you remember being caught in a cloud of Agent Orange when you were over in Vietnam?
Not really a cloud of it, but okay.
Background.
When I went over to Nam, I was an engineer, heavy equipment repairman. And I got into combat because of doing convoys from where I was in the Delta. If we had equipment couldn't be repaired, we'd convoy it to Saigon where it gets shipped out of the country. And my main job was flying by helicopter out to remote MACV and Special Forces places to work on engineer equipment. Like generators are an engineer equipment. And if you're a small station, if you didn't have a working generator, pretty soon your radios wouldn't work, your perimeter lights didn't work, and most importantly, you couldn't have cold beer. So people would treat me well to fly out and fix things, but I remember flying with helicopters that said the day before they spent the whole day spraying Agent Orange. Wow. And then when I was on guard duty at a station, your whole area of fire would be cleared by Agent Orange. And so they just dumped it indiscriminately all over
that
poor country.
And napalm, too. I mean, I've seen movies from Vietnam, and you just see these villages just go up in unending flames spreading out. I mean,
that was a terrible situation. That was a war that shouldn't have been, obviously.
Yeah. Did you feel that way then?
I did.
When you were over there?
Yeah. But like I say, when you had the lifelong job of that you wanted, you couldn't say I object to the war and it's time to go to Canada, you know?
Right. So I was under the impression that when you went to Alaska, you went to the new parks that Jimmy Carter had created, Yukon Charlie. And
I was at Glacier Bay for 8 years.
Okay.
And then I went to the new park, and that was and I was up there during that real tumultuous period when the new parks were being discussed and when Carter, nothing was being done in Congress, and he declared them all national monuments.
Right.
And really pissed Alaskans off.
Yeah.
You know? And it was, you know, there were a lot of tense situations up in Alaska then. And that's when I transferred from Glacier Bay to Yukon Charlotte. So I lived in Eagle, little small town right on the Yukon River.
And were you the superintendent of Yukon Charlotte?
Yeah. It's real small staff, but about a 2 million acre park or a preserve.
Right.
So you could sport hunt in the preserve, and it had a lot of gold mining areas in it. In fact, I've just heard Sheila dug up something where wood chopper area is up for sale right now as a gold mining area.
Okay. Did you retire from Yukon Charlie?
I transferred from Yukon Charlie, and the last place I was superintendent at Bering Land Bridge out of Nome. So that gave me, you know, the three distinct different areas in Alaska to live and work in. Southeast Alaska there at Glacier Bay, and then the interior, extreme interior at Eagle, and then sort of the Arctic coast there working at Nome. Right. And I was just there 2 years, and I took one of those early out things. My mother was living here. My father passed away right at the time I transferred to Eagle. And so my mother was here living alone, really enjoying
in Prescott.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's my mother, while I was at Grand Canyon, my mother and dad moved from Southern California to Prescott. I didn't pressure them for that, but I thought that was the smartest thing they ever did.
Wow.
I thought Prescott was really a pretty neat town.
And it was a lot smaller then, wasn't it?
Oh, it was, yeah. That was
before it was discovered.
Yeah, they were at the leading edge. I think that I think after they moved was when that AARP magazine article came out with one of the best places to retire.
Wow. So they would have moved here probably in the mid-80s?
They moved here in 76, I think it was.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
A lot earlier.
And they have a modest place in town. They sold their place in California. I think they still owed money on it, you know. And so they didn't have much bucks at all, and they bought a modest place here. But my mother was living there, and I had put in an application to get to a park to be closer to her, and I wasn't selected for that. And this thing of an early out came up, and I said, hey, why not? And so I would spend my summers up in Alaska working on my cabin in Haines, and then spend my winter down here, which is when my mother needed help, making medical appointments and stuff like that, you know.
Is that where you live, is in her modest house, or did you
I buy did.
It? You did live there.
I had, before I retired, I had bought 10 acres out at Coyote Springs.
Oh, okay.
You know, and out on the road from...
On the White Spar?
Well, you know, the road that goes from Prescott Valley over to Jerome?
Yes. Oh, that, Coyote Springs. On
Coyote Springs off there. I bought 10 acres back there for $11,000 or something.
Jeez.
I think I was probably working and living at Glacier Bay when I bought that. I just bought it as an investment, thinking maybe I would do something. And so when I retired, I set up that I could live there, but I ended up living with my mother most of the winters here.
I see.
Yeah.
So what year did you retire?
90, what was that, 95, 96, something like that.
Oh, wow. I could have bumped into you at Nome.
Really?
Yeah, I believe it was 1994. This was right after the Iron Curtain went down. And so all of a sudden, these tour companies that I work for, they started doing trips from Nome to St. Lawrence Island, to the Diomedes.
Which company did you work for?
Well, at that time, it was called Clipper Cruise Lines.
Yeah.
They're out of business now. But they were on the World Discoverer, and me and my first wife, Susanna, we did like four trips out of Nome that summer.
I remember one of the ships that pulled into Nome, the woman that was in charge of the programs on the ships had been a seasonal working at Glacier Bay. I can't remember her name now. And so I was invited to dinner with the...
On the ship.
The captain's crew and stuff.
Yeah.
It was very impressive, but... And I forgot which ship that was anyway, but
Well, I think we even took...
The last thing I did for the government, I was part of an international planning team with Audubon Society and native people from Kotzebue and from Nome, and we traveled over by airplane over to Providencia and then traveled by Vista Hotte and stuff to the villages, putting on a program about what Bering-Lambridge National Park could do on that side of the border.
Nice.
But, and that was right before the government just fell apart, and so nothing much was done on. They did designate some individual areas, but not the big...
We visited Cape Dezhnev, which is the easternmost part of Siberia.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's as close to Alaska as any other place is, and we did the hike up to the top of the hill and looked out. Wow.
Very neat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, our lives have
We've had several places where we've crossed. Yeah.
I want to ask you, you did the search and rescue at Grand Canyon. Did you learn your climbing skills at Kings Canyon, Sequoia?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, Bill Wendt was my the district ranger, or sub-district ranger at Cedar Grove when I had the fire crew down there. And so he really, he was the one that gave us all the, I was doing rock climbing and stuff before that, but okay. Hadn't really got into the rescue thing until I was there at Cedar Grove at Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks.
So the reason I ask you, did you have any memorable climbs in the Grand Canyon? Have you been to the top of Vishnu Temple? Have you been to Zoroaster Temple?
No, nothing in the way of memorable things.
But you did climb some temples?
We did an attempt on Vishnu, but it was the main thing that turned us around was... it was a little warmer than what we figured, and our water was running low. And I think we had enough equipment with us to get by the one real difficult spot we would have had. And we were doing okay on it, but we ended up backing off of that one.
Okay.
But I just had a lot of fun doing other side hikes there, poking around as many of the caves as I could, because I got involved in caving at Sequoia National Park, too.
Oh, wow.
There was... some of the caves we went into were in the National Forest area, just outside the park, and Lost Soldiers Cave and some stuff like that. But doing a little bit of caving and poking around in caves at Grand Canyon was always fun to do.
Wow, so... I had a hydrologist tell me that the name of Grand Canyon should be Cave National Park. Uh-huh. Apparently there are just caves everywhere. And you know how spelunkers are. You say, what about this cave? Oh, I didn't know there was a cave there.
Yeah. Well, and they keep it secret.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know that, and there was a spelunking group. I don't know where they were out of. They might have been out of a combination of Flagstaff and some other cities.
Yeah.
And I got invited to go along with them, and we went into that that big drop. What do they call that one? It's like Devil's Hole or something.
Okay.
It's really not much of a cave for exploring, but you go to it just because it's such a long free drop, and then you have to jumar back up out of it.
Wow.
And that was on, because I think that caving group came up to the canyon and did some things, and I was sort of worked with them to make sure they stayed within bounds of what they were authorized to do.
I knew some of those cavers at the geology department at NAU. There probably were some of the people you might have interacted with. What about memorable hikes in the Grand Canyon? Or they don't have to be memorable, but I'm just trying to flesh out some of the things you did, maybe either for work or recreation in the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
Because back then in your day, in my day when we were at Grand Canyon, there was no such thing as the Escalante route.
Yeah.
That connects Tanner with Hance. But that is essentially a trail now.
We did that as that connection, but it was not a trail,
no.
So that has been completed sort of as a,
You hike most of the trails in Grand Canyon?
I think I did.
You hiked Kermit?
All the little trails, I tried to do all of them. There's some off the North Rim I hadn't done.
Okay.
But I did do that. What is it, Kanab Creek, that you can take all the way down? You have several rappels and stuff. Yeah, I did that with a friend of mine from Bishop that did the snow surveys for us, the state and stuff. And I think we hitched a ride with some boats when we got down to the river or something.
Okay.
That was a fun trip.
Did you do a complete river trip in the Grand Canyon?
I think I did five of them.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, four or five. But some of them weren't complete. I did four or five trips that I was on. But like there was one time, I think when I did the, I'd been to Si Papu Trail, that I hitched a ride on boats heading down and got off at Phantom.
Okay.
And I did that Si Papu Trail with Orchi Baca, who was part Hopi.
Okay.
And when we got to the Si Papu, he had prayer feathers he placed there, and I stepped well back from the deal and just let him do his thing.
So you came down the Salt Trail to get
there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I did that once. And I had always told myself that as a geologist, I would have no qualms about visiting the Si Papu.
Yeah.
You know, there always was the thing, it's very sacred and you don't want to go there casually. And
it's a power spot.
It is. And I got there, we hiked down the Salt Trail and we got to the Si Papu. I had been telling myself my whole career at Grand Canyon that if I ever got there as a geologist, I would want to go and see it and sort of check out what it is. When I got there, it didn't feel right, and I, like you, backed off.
Yeah.
And my two other friends climbed up to the top of it and looked down in the hole, and I said, no, I'm not going.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's another thing. On the staff out at Desert View, I had a Hopi and a Navajo on the team, Orchi Baca, and Navajos, I was keeping track with him. Eli, his father was a shaman on the Native American church thing. In fact, it was funny. Sometimes his parents would come to our potluck parties at Desert View, you know, and I thought that really. That helped out at Desert View is having a Navajo and a Hopi on your work crew out there.
Yeah. But, they were probably on the maintenance crew?
I think Orchi was a ranger and Eli was worked the entrance station or something.
Oh, okay.
You know, because we had that entrance station, which is the most boring job, but we could make that a little better by doing training and cross training and whoever was on road patrol, you'd make him work the entrance station while somebody else got out and did some things.
You know? I see. Fantastic. What are your memories of Rick Gale, who was the unit manager on the North Rim? Remember he used to have his mint julep parties?
Yeah, I went to one of his mint julep parties, and yeah, they were...
They were a thing to look forward to.
They certainly were. Well, Rick was at Lake Mead after I got out of the Army and I went back there. You know, when I went to Lake Mead, originally, people weren't really proud to be rangers there. They weren't wearing their uniform very well, you know, who cares about polished boots? But when you wear the uniform, you should be doing with some pride, and they were sort of downtrodden. And Rick came in as either chief ranger or assistant chief ranger, and he turned that park around in having pride being working there, you know.
Wow.
And had a pistol shooting team that would go to some of these big meets and stuff, and where you could improve your skills, but you'd sort of have a lot of fun doing this much stuff too. And Rick was good at doing that. Sheila was doing some administrative work when Rick got caught in some kind of impropriety with payroll and stuff. And in Sheila's mind, like if you're ever talking to Sheila if we ever get together later on, it's a good idea not to bring up too much about Rick.
Oh, okay.
She's got some real negative feelings where I don't have those negative feelings.
I vaguely remember when he left the North Rim and it was very sudden and kind of a shock to everybody because like you, I think his staff liked him a lot.
Yeah, a lot.
There was a really good vibe on the North Rim.
Yeah, there definitely was.
He was responsible for a lot of that, and I do remember that when he left, it was kind of like, what?
But they had that one seasonal that was involved in a rape and...
Oh, really?
They had a couple of real tough things, but that I don't know any of the details on it, but it was something involved there.
And then the assistant unit manager on the North Rim was Jack Fields.
Yeah.
Remember Jack?
Yeah.
And Jack was kind of like Ernie Kunzel, who I want to get back to after this. He was like Ernie in that he was always moving forward towards busting people with marijuana.
Yeah.
And in his office, he had a framed hanging on the wall that had all these marijuana pipes that he had confiscated. And he had it on the wall because he could determine who smoked marijuana if they would look at that and sort of stare at it.
Yeah.
If you didn't know what it was, you might think, oh, these are like ceremonial pipes from Ghana or something. But it was funny. So anyway, when we spoke on the phone the other day, we did mention Ernie Kunzel a little bit, and he was maybe the chief law enforcement ranger. He was there at Grand Canyon for a long time. I don't know if you want to say anything more about him. I will preface this by saying he called me out of the blue 7 or 8 years ago and wanted to talk. And he's another guy that thinks he was poisoned deliberately while on a river trip in Mexico.
Oh, really? Oh.
He started having some health problems.
Yeah.
He was very paranoid when he reappeared in my life, but I thought, oh, this would be a great oral history. Because Ernie had one of the largest reputations on the South Rim of Grand Canyon.
Yeah, he did.
He would go out of his way.
The team out at Desert View got called out to rescue Ernie. He was on a rescue, somebody down off of... if you go down the Kaibab Trail and you get down to where there's a ranger station and stuff, what's...
The Kaibab or the Bright Angel?
The Bright Angel. Yeah, the Bright Angel.
So you have Indian Garden, called Havasupai Garden.
And there's some rocks around there that you can climb on. And there's somebody got stuck on the rocks or something. And essentially, instead of Ernie getting around the back and rappelling down to him where they could have got him off real clean, he was going to do some aid climbing up to him, and he pulled a pin.
Oh.
And when he fell, he didn't have movement or didn't have feeling in his legs and stuff. So he requested, rather sensibly, to get an immobilization evacuation. And the only people in the park that could go do it was Desert View, and we'd had some kind of training thing. And we'd finished the training thing, and we're all sitting around and drinking beers, and we had to go from sober up because we got to go rescue Ernie. And when we got down to him, I can remember we got Ernie into one of Stokes' litters, and he said, "You got a belay on it?" You know, I said, "Oh, hey, Cunningham, take care of that belay." And so Cunningham took a little... one of the rigging ropes, about a 20-foot rope, and tied it on the deal, and they just threw it on the ground. Ernie didn't know there wasn't anybody on that rope, but he knew there was a rope there that we told him that was a belay rope. And we hauled him out of the canyon there.
In a litter?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And he was fine.
Yeah.
No serious damage, but he was right in saying, you know, if he suspected some kind of a back fracture or something... You know, didn't want to take chances on that.
I wonder if this was on the battleship. There's a big rock.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. I think it was on the battleship.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm certain we did filled out one of those reports on that one, but I can't remember details. But
well, those reports still exist at the museum at Grand Canyon. We'll have to look that one up and see what the report says.
Yeah.
Yeah, anything else about Would he ever come out to Desert View?
Well, we had, there was a motorcycle accident on the road out there that I think we got to first, and we had EMTs out at Desert View, and I was an EMT, but we'd just barely got into where we were doing injectable drugs or anything. We were pretty much sort of the basic EMT, and where Ernie really took it couple steps higher and was very good at it.
Right.
But I can remember this motorcyclist was laying there when we would have surmised the whole incident and getting a report ready, and I think Spider was controlling traffic even. And then Ernie comes running up, and he comes out of the car with his EMT kit open, and he had a syringe or something, and it was shaking. And the motorcycle was sort of big, and he says, "Get that fucking guy with the needle away from me." I believe was the quote. And so he said, "Okay, we'll take care of it."
Oh, that's funny. Oh, well, let's see what we got here. We got an hour and 15 minutes.
Well, that's pretty good.
That is really good. You've done really good. I just wonder, any last reminiscences about Grand Canyon?
It just feels good reminiscing about the place and the people.
Yes.
And it's a magical spot, and it's a privilege to have spent time there.
Very much so.
So I thank you for the time and bringing up some of those good times, too. It was pretty nice.
You still feel close to the canyon? Do you get a chance to go there once in a while?
I have friends that want to do a view of the canyon. I've gone up with them, and we, especially taking the time and doing that whole drive out to Desert View, making that loop and stopping at all those points.
Yeah.
It's pretty nice.
Did you ever know Joe Alston?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, he lives here.
Have you been to his home?
I have.
Boy, that is a nice one, isn't it?
And he got it for $800,000 because it was a distressed sale back in the housing crisis.
That's probably a $3 million home now.
Oh, my God.
Well, it's right there on the trail that goes to...
He backs up to Forest Service.
Huh?
He backs his house backs up to Forest Service.
Yeah.
I just wondered if you knew him and if you see him here, and it sounds like you do.
I've met some other Park Service friends that we'd out at his place in years past.
Okay.
You know, but I haven't seen him in several years. But I thought he would have been a good person to roll in to be in director of that the museum here in town. But because it was vacant there for a while, but he wasn't interested in.
Yeah, I think he's enjoying the retired life. Are you talking about Charlotte Hall?
Charlotte Hall, yeah.
Well, that's where you and I reconnected when my wife Helen had her lecture program there.
The
Grand Canyon Association.
Yeah. Well, and the Indigenous Peoples Museum is really, that they've really cleaned that up, and then I guess on their board of directors, they've got several Native peoples now, and so a whole different direction, you know. Very nice. I was active with the archaeology club here in town.
Okay.
Which Euler got me into originally. You had to have a member sort of vouch for you to be a member, and now they're just crying out for members. It's really dwindled down. Wow. Most of the old timers have all died off and stuff. But we still use the meeting room over there at what was Smoke Eye.
Smoke Eye, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Don, this has been wonderful, and I sure do appreciate your reminiscences of Grand Canyon and your career, and it's nice to capture all of these.
It's nice to talk to you, and sorry that it was so difficult for you to... for me to make a time when we could connect. That's too bad that it became that way.
I made it work.
Yeah, it was very good.
Thank you.
Do you want me to sign off on that thing there?